Accession number 1803, reel 4.
Ron Yetman, reel 4.
Well, I wouldn't like to say what they were. They were mutilated. I'd seen the charred bodies before. I'd seen dead bodies before. But these bodies that had been chewed by, I can't. Describe it. It was something that I do see even now. I do see occasionally they were mutilated. I wouldn't like to say whose bodies they were, but whosever they were, they didn't deserve that. They were literally thousands of rats. Where they'd come from, I don't know.
So when you say mutilated, you mean chewed up by the rats?
Chewed by the rats. With no wild animals there to chew them. And then coming back down, we were crossing the Han River on the Al Jolson Bridge. We were this was after we pulled off of Frostbite Ridge. We were fighting rear guard all the way down, or fighting, acting as rear guard all the way down. And we, in actual fact, my platoon, 5 platoon, the last but one platoon to cross the Han River on the Al Jolson Bridge before the engineer platoon came after us and blew it up. And then we just carried back on down again to another place we called another Frostbite Ridge. There we met the Turkish brigade. The Turks were fighting this. Long great coats down to their ankles, passing through us to take on the Chinese. They sustained very, very heavy casualties that day. And I can remember Doc Holdeen and Cooper all being sent from our medical aid station to help the Turkish doctors. They were so poorly equipped medically. We had good medical attention. We might have to wait for it. But for the amount of Turks, there were 5,000. I think the Turks had about 2 doctors that had to look after them. And I know our medical officer, Doc Holdeen, went. I think the Middlesex doctor went, but that I wouldn't swear to, because that was only rumour. And they were using the Indian forward hospital unit to evacuate the Turkish casualties. We didn't see them, but we could hear them on the radio when various reports were coming through. You could listen in and hear the various reports coming through from various people. The casualties of the Turkish brigade were very, very heavy.
What kind of soldiers did they make?
Oh, they were great soldiers. They used to say, "I will fight with the English or fight against the English." They didn't want to know the Americans. They didn't want to know the Australians, although the Australians were good. Very reliable. So were the Turks, but they preferred to fight with the English. One or two of them that could speak English that we did see occasionally, Ah, English, great, great, good soldiers, Americans, no, we then moved back and stayed in this old position, and this was, I'm jumping about here, we're going back to March now, beginning of March, where we'd taken up another position on another ridge, and again we were holding, allowing the Americans to build up again, but we were a bit isolated there because our rations, we couldn't get, there was no road there, but we're just in the hills, and our rations were parachuted into us by the American Air Force. Were on their rations. They were very tasty rations, but they had no guts in them. They weren't sustaining. After you'd done about 5 or 10 miles on the hoof, all the food that you'd had in the ration pack, 24, had gone. There was no body in it. Every chance we had, we used to swap our American rations for a tin of bully beef and a packet of hardtack. And you could go all day on that without feeling hunger, but as I say, the American rations were good. They had all the goodies in it, but they didn't keep you going. At least they never kept me going, some of the others. And then one of our last jobs was to act as start line for the Australian regiment, Aussies. So we advanced and cleared the area for the America, for the Australian battalion on the start line. This was the end of March, towards the end of March. And the Australians came through, started their advance, and again they took heavy casualties. I think their CO was killed. And a friend I'd made there, a chap named Staff Waterfield, I know he was injured because I heard his name come through on the radio as one of the wounded. We'd had replacements this time. We'd had a draft of the King's... Well, we'd had a draft from all Scottish regiments that had joined us about 10 days prior to this, middle of March, they joined us. And this was the time we were told that we were pulling out of Korea, we were going back to Hong Kong. This included Speakman, Bill Speakman, who eventually got the VC with the Scottish Borderers. He was one of the replacements. He was in B Company. But again, he wasn't in 5 Platoon with me. And they thought, oh, good, this is good. Pulling out, going home. I've only been out here 4 days. But then the King's Own Scottish Borderers arrived and relieved us. And all the recent replacements that we had were transferred from the Argylls to the King's Own Scottish Borderers to make up their strength. So they stayed there, and later Speakman got his VC. And then we stayed there, and then we walked a few miles, and there waiting for us was our transport, and drove us to Incheon, to the docks at Incheon, where we boarded the USS Montrose for our trip back to Hong Kong. It was a 5-day trip by boat, and again, to provide entertainment for us, they laid on a boxing tournament. And I don't know if the American Navy thought they were going to get an easy ride against the regiment, because they'd done no physical training or anything for, 6 months, 7 months. And the few regimental boxing team that remained were asked if they would like to represent the regiment again, or whether they were too tired, and they said, no, we'll fight. And they beat the USS Montrose 10-0. I'll never forget it. They won every belt on the boat. And it just shows that the morale at that time was good. Really good. We had our ups and downs, but it was very... It was an experience.
Was this Captain Mitchell the one who made a name for himself in Aden later on?
Yeah, Colin Mitchell, yeah.
What was the Al Jolson Bridge?
Well, I forgot to mention that. When we were at Guarding Corps HQ, Al Jolson, the entertainer, I don't know if you know him.
Indeed.
Indeed.
Not personally, but I've heard his songs.
You've heard his songs. I've had the privilege of seeing him in live. And I think he must have been the greatest personality ever to appear on stage. He was in a big bowl, say one of the few privileged, because this was when B Company were detached to guard Corps headquarters. He came down and done a concert. And although we were only there ourselves for an hour and a half, the man never stopped, and apparently he'd been going for a good hour before we got there. And when we left to go back to relieve the others, they allowed us to go down to see the concert. And when the time we got back to relieve the others, he was still going. And apparently he was going non-stop for over 4 hours. And they built a Bailey Bridge, or pontoon bridge, across the Han River. And they called it the Al Jolson Bridge. I had crossed the Han River earlier on the ice. And the ice was thick enough to take 3-ton trucks, although they were a bit dodgy and I was a bit apprehensive. But the Americans, they went across the Han River on the ice in their vehicles. We walked across. We eventually got back to Hong Kong. We were all deloused and dewormed. Some people had worms from eating the food out there, livestock that they'd seen, they'd shot to supplement the rations that we had. They butchered the pigs themselves and eaten it. And as a result, some of them had got worms. We got back and all dewormed, deloused, issued with new jungle greens. Weren't allowed out of camp the first night. And I think 99% of the regiment were drunk the first night in camp. And that was it.
Can I just go back and ask you some more questions about Korea? What did you think of the enemy when you were there?
Crafty. They weren't what I'd call trained soldiers. They were hordes. They used to send them up in hordes. They would blow bugles and shout at the top of their voices, "Banzai, Banzai," hundreds of them coming. And you'd open fire on them, and they still kept coming and coming. There didn't seem to be any tactics like we had tactics. If we were moving forward, you'd move a section at a time. A section would leapfrog one another. Half a dozen men would run forward, lay down, take up a position, open fire, and another behind them would move forward and then forward again, leapfrogging all the time. But the North Koreans, they just seemed to come in hordes. They didn't seem to have any... tactical training. They were just a group of men with an officer or an NCO that would turn around and say, charge, and they would charge. Blowing bugles, banging cymbals, drums, anything that they could lay their hands on. But they used to get to a certain point and the bodies would be lying there, and then they would stop and turn back and run downhill again. Later, well, say earlier, the North Koreans, some of them, I imagine they must have been regular soldiers, seem to have some little sense of battle training. We'd often, in the hills, we'd come across a hole in the ground, and you never turned your back on it. Somebody would fire down the hole or drop a grenade down the hole, because you didn't know if there was a Korean in the bottom of it. Some of the holes we investigated when we had the time, and we'd find a bag of rice, a bit of a uniform or something like that. Signs of occupancy at the bottom of the holes. They used to dig in, and when you pass through them, come awake at the back of you and attack you from the rear. This is what happened in one case in, I forget where it was. It was in North Korea. There had been a bit of a firefight, and the bodies were laying there, and I can't remember if it was Mr. Haddo or Mr. Earl, Captain Mitchell, one or other of them anyway, was looking at the alleged wounded, and he rolled one over with his foot, and he opened an eye, this North Korean, and he shot him, and he shouted at the same time, "Take cover, they're not dead." So I can't remember which officer it was. Anyway, he done his quick scarper and got out of the way as we opened fire on the bodies that were laying on the ground. They done this same trick with this American artillery unit that we relieved and released in North Korea. Some pretended to be dead and they just lay in the fields. Others had infiltrated and gone through, and this is where we attacked them from the rear. They completely surrounded this American artillery unit, and some of them had, during the firefight that occurred, had got up in the middle and opened fire, actually in the gunner's positions. Although they were quickly picked off by one or two of our boys with their rifles. They didn't seem all that well trained. It seemed as if they were called up or mobilised, whatever you like to call it, given a rifle and said, "Here, you're a soldier." That was my impression.
Were these human wave attacks that you described by the North Koreans or the Chinese, or both?
The North Koreans used to use the hidey holes and pretend to be dead. The Chinese although we fought the Chinese, we didn't really have much in the way that we had with the North Koreans. You know, they seemed to take most of their dead with them. Pardon me, take most of their dead with them. Although the burnt corpses they used to leave behind where they'd been napalmed.
But all that business of rushing forward without tactics and banging cymbals and so on, was that the North Koreans?
That was North Koreans. And the Chinese use the same tactics, very similar. I think the North Korean army probably was trained by Chinese, although there were very strong rumours that Charlie Company had taken some prisoners, and among the prisoners were a couple of Russian officers. Now, whether they were actually training, commanding, or what with North Koreans, I don't know. And I don't know what happened to them. All I know is that Charlie and company had captured a couple of Russians, and we were said that, well, the Russians are in the war, that's it, you know, among ourselves. But after 3 or 4 days, everybody had forgotten about it. It was something else going on.
Was there much difference in the amount of fighting which the four rifle companies did? Or did some companies get more fighting than the others?
A and B Company took a lot. Took more than C and D Company. It was just unfortunate the way the orders were given and the various O groups dictated and the tactics dictated that A and B Company just seemed to be unlucky. If four companies going forward in a straight line, it just seemed that they, to an unknown position, it just seemed that A and B Company were in the wrong position at the wrong time. It was never ever deliberate. I mean, Charlie Company did suffer casualties. In actual fact, Charlie Company were the last company. One incident, I forget where it was. It was towards the end, before we pulled out. So it was in South Korea, because we was south of the 38th parallel by then. They'd taken, pushed into one position, and they'd had two or three dead and six or seven wounded, I think, in that last skirmish they had. But that was probably a fortnight, 3 weeks before we pulled out of Korea.
Was there much difference between operating in North Korea as to South Korea, or could you not tell the difference?
You couldn't tell the difference. The countries, basically, North Korea was industrial, South Korea was agricultural. It was flatter in South Korea than it was in North Korea, in as much as the valleys in South Korea seemed to be wider, and therefore capable of producing farming stuff, agricultural stuff. But North Korea, the mountains seem to be closer together, and the valleys narrower, and the hills were steeper. It's a place I didn't think I'd go back to anyway.
Did you ever return?
No. I always swore that if I was ever posted back to Korea later, that I would never go back. I would go absent first, but whether I would have done or not, I don't know.
There's one or two things that occur to you that you feel you've missed out.
Funny incidents, really. One day we were going up, it was dark. The CQMS had pulled up alongside a building. He'd put a tarpaulin up, brain gun carrier over the top of the brain gun carrier. And we were going in to get our hot meal at night. He'd cooked the meal up. And this was in South Korea. And at the side of the house was a big cesspit. They didn't have sanitation like we have. They used to go to a big cesspit, and then it was dug out or siphoned out and flooded with the rice paddies. And I didn't see this. I'd come in with mess tins in my hand to get my meal. And it was a narrow squeeze along the side of this brain carrier to get to where the CQMS was dishing out. And of course, I stood on the edge and went straight into the cesspit. Come out, died. God almighty, I've never smelled anything like it in my life. Everybody shied away from me. I even shared my pup tent that night on my own, soaking wet. I managed, it was one of the few areas where we had fires going at night, and I managed to get my jacket off and my shirt off and put it in front of the fire, washed it out with cold water, put it in front of the fire to dry. Eventually I got one of my mates to lend me something warm to put on me, because although it was warm, hot during the day, the nights got a bit chilly, and it wasn't the sort of area where you could walk around at night with your shirt off like you can in some other tropical places. But none of the lads spoke to me for days. "Get away, get away," was a cry. It was in my hair and everywhere. Couldn't get a bath in that area. But we always improvised. I managed to get my hair washed. I couldn't get a haircut, though. I think I went, 4 months, 5 months without a haircut, because everybody was lousy. We had one or two typhus scares among the civilian population, and we all had body lice. Even the CO had body lice. These are the odd times when we could get near enough to CQMS to scram some DDT powder. If it's too cold to take your shirt off, you just use DDT powder like talcum powder. Another time,